Welcome to the Anxiety at Work podcast. I'm Chester Elton, and this is my co-author and dear friend, Adrian Gostick.
We hope the time you're going to spend with us is going to help remove the stigma of anxiety and mental health in the workplace and your personal life. So we invite experts in the world of work and life on this podcast to give you ideas and, most importantly, tools to deal with anxiety in your world.
And our guest today is Dr. Lloyd Setterer. Dr. Setterer is an adjunct professor at Columbia University in the School of Public Health. He has also been the medical director of McLean Hospital, a Harvard teaching hospital, was the mental health commissioner of New York City, and the author of 13 books. His most recent books are The Addiction Solution and Ink Stained for Life. Welcome to the show, Lloyd. You know, I always called you doctor, and you said, no, please call me Lloyd. We are delighted to have you on our humble podcast.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and your mission is one that is something that all of us experience, anxiety at work, or what, even if our work is at home, not just virtual, but our work is our home, children. This is ubiquitous, and you're offering a way to help people live better despite it.
Well, thank you so much again for coming on and for that opening salvo. We're so excited to talk to you about mental health and the ways leaders can better understand what problems it poses to their staff. There's probably few people around who are better qualified to talk about this. So to start off, we'd like to ask about your perception of the state of mental health. Of course, with everything that's going on with COVID, the pandemic, but not only that, younger people coming into the workplace that are more apt to talk about mental health. So give us a little bit of the state of the union of mental health and if you feel like it's becoming more of a priority in business.
Well, your point that COVID has been a game changer in so many ways that even before COVID, while there was evidence that there are greater rates, earlier occurrence of different disorders, depression, anxiety, substance use, the opioid epidemic, since COVID, unquestionably, there have been higher rates of a whole set of different kinds of problem behaviors, distress, and disorders. And I see that as the consequence of the irony of this illness. The very thing that we've had to do for a year now is isolate ourselves from other people. And other people are the way by which we're social creatures. We need other people. And whatever conditions or vulnerabilities we have are more pronounced when we don't have the contact with people we care about and who care about us.
You know, that's so interesting. You know, as we were writing the book, Anxiety at Work, and doing our research, the more we talk to people about anxiety, and the more we realize how anxious that word makes people. You want to talk about anxiety, but you don't want to make people anxious, right? So we understand that anxiety is just a natural human response. But I think people believe that if they acknowledge that problem exists, that they have to confront it. If people don't know how to confront their anxiety, then it makes sense that talking about it would cause more anxiety, right? So for someone who is experiencing stress-induced anxiety, what are one or two things you would recommend for people to address those feelings?
Well, I can understand how people are reluctant to speak about it if they see it or frame it as a problem. And in fact, I think one of the ways of mastering anxiety is to see it as an opportunity. Anxiety focuses our mind. Anxiety improves our performance. Anxiety makes us more alert and alive. So it is about finding ways to harness it, to see anxiety as a normal response to whatever challenge we're facing. And to find ways to say, okay, I'm about to be on a podcast. I feel a little nervous. I'm going to use that with you guys.
Yeah, you know, I love what you say about that because it's so interesting. As Adrian and I would present, like you say, I'm getting ready for the podcast. People would always ask me, they say, do you get nervous before you present? And I'd say, every time. And they say, really? I mean, you've been doing this for years. I said, you know what? If you're not a little anxious, I don't think you care. So I love that idea about harnessing anxiety, right, Adrian?
Absolutely. Now, I think the one of the issues, and again, we've got a world expert here on this idea of mental health. I want to get into some of the specific questions that many of our listeners have. Like, for instance, what exactly is anxiety and how is it different than stress? As somebody who has studied this for decades, and then, you know, how as a leader can I understand how to use that information? So if you could help us understand those terms a little bit.
Yeah. It's easy to see how the two are confounded or may, in fact, overlap in many ways. But stress is a reaction to a circumstance, to an event, to a demand upon our us. And it is also quite normal or frequent. And it's the problem is not so much the stress of the moment, but chronic stress. And we can come back to that. Anxiety is a state of mind and body characterized by fear and apprehension. When its magnitude is greater, it has the quality of a disorder. It becomes a disorder. And we have categories of different anxiety disorders, generalized anxiety, OCD, PTSD. So anxiety is much more of a discrete phenomena. It is sometimes, of course, produced by circumstance or events, and sometimes not so much.
And as a follow-up to that, the cultures, the work cultures that we see talking about mental health seem to us to have a little bit of a leg up because so many people are suffering now. Why do you think there's still a pervasive stigma around discussing mental health in the workplace, and how do leaders overcome that?
Yes. When I was mental health commissioner for New York City, we were able to get a very large FEMA grant to respond to the mental health problems post 9/11. And we did that for 3 years. We touched the lives of 750,000 New Yorkers. And we discovered a couple really important things that I think have bearing on what you're working on right now. The first is that we learned that distress was ubiquitous. You went around New York and people were distressed. And we said it is normal to feel distress and anxiety in an abnormal situation. That this is not a disease or disorder. It can become that, but in fact, you are responding to an extraordinary event, a frightening event, an event that unprecedented. So that was the first thing. And the second, going back to your point, is that our tagline for that three-year effort with the city was, even heroes need to talk. And I think the thing that allows distress or anxiety to breed, to grow, is going it alone, trying to keep it to yourself. And that's why we had that tagline, especially because some of the most distressed people in the city were first responders, firefighters, police, EMTs, and those that worked in the pile. I mean, this was, they kept it to themselves, and often when they did, there's solution, their remedy to quiet themselves was often far greater use of alcohol, drugs, tobacco, and food, which is also another comforting way we manage our feelings.
You know, it's so interesting I love that tagline, even heroes need to talk, because people do try to go alone, you know. And as we come back to the workplace, you know, the work and research that we've done over the last 20 years just on workplace culture, it seems that the more a work culture provides that mental safety, the more cohesive it is, the more able they are to adapt to changes as they come along. The cultures that have mental health on the list of priorities, you know, they seem to just do better, right? But we still see that companies aren't talking about the issue. Why do you think there's such a pervasive stigma around mental health, especially in the workplace? Why isn't it safe to talk about this in the workplace yet?
Well, I think that's very understandable, because we're all concerned about holding on to our jobs, getting that advancement. It's not a good asterisk to have after your name. Oh, that this guy talks about being nervous all the time, or, you know, he's on medications, whatnot. So I do think that a certain discretion is normative, because unless you know for sure that it's okay, you don't want to do it. And you may want to do it with trusted friends. I've been a chief medical officer of a media company this past year, and we recorded sessions between doctors and nurses in the first COVID surge in the spring. And these were at two major medical centers, New York Presbyterian and Massachusetts General Hospital. And we discovered that, indeed, they needed to talk, but they certainly weren't saying a word at the hospital. There was no way that they were going to turn to their chief or the president of the hospital when he or she asked, how you doing? They're going to say, oh, just fine. They put on their game face. And terribly also, or protectively, they would not want to talk about their experiences, particularly then when people were dying one after the other. They were so helpless, powerless. They didn't want to bring that home. And they had the feeling that nobody could understand what they were going through except somebody who was going through it themselves, a little bit like war veterans. Mm-hmm. And so we created these private, anonymized conversations. It was a feature article in the New York Times on June 22nd. Doctors are COVID's first historians. And we did doctors, and then we did nurses. And it was absolutely break your heart to listen to them talk to each other about their experiences. And they could do so because they knew the other person. They knew that person was living the life that they were living. And there was no way that that was going to get to their department chief or the hospital executives. And watching those after a while, our purpose was to record, identify the experience of healthcare workers in the midst of an unprecedented pandemic. But inadvertently, we saw in every single exchange, because these went on several weeks, once or twice a week, we saw that they helped each other. And it became a type of peer support that enabled them to stay the course, which was really hard.
So in the workplace, though, I guess the closest thing that we've seen to that, right, Adrian, is where the leader becomes vulnerable and talks about their anxiety, you know, when you're talking about peer-to-peer. So is that one of the ways that you can kind of remove that stigma, is when the leader can say, hey, I've noticed a couple things going on. Listen, if you're anxious, don't worry about it. I'm anxious, too. So is that the kind of advice? Would that get to a closer of a peer-to-peer kind of relationship?
A little bit, but not enough, I think, because there's a power inequity between the CEO of, I don't know, Google, or the CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, and some nurse assistant or person on cleaning services, or even some of the doctors and that executive. So they don't necessarily identify with that person. That person's not doing what they're doing. And they know that person is a person of privilege. So it is, does break the ice a little, but I don't think it mitigates the, an individual's experience unless they're a CEO too.
It's so powerful what you're saying. Now, one of your recent books was The Addiction Solution. So, you know, addiction, as you saw post 9/11, as you mentioned, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, drugs, food, which is, you know, is a fascinating idea too. A lot of people listening either find themselves coming down with some addictions or becoming a, you know, a victim of addiction, or they have a loved one who has an addiction. Now, the whole hope in that title is there's a solution. So maybe talk about addiction, how that impacts work, and any kind of ideas about how we normalize these problems, but also maybe helps people that we care about.
Yes. The premise of that book, I'm a public health doctor, the premise of that book was that people use drugs, alcohol, tobacco, because it serves them. We often think about people whose lives have been pirated away by opioids or alcohol, that there's something the matter with them, and also there's a lot troubling about their behaviors when their life is organized around a substance. They lie, they betray, they steal. But people use substances for a purpose. There's not a society on earth that doesn't use intoxicating substances. And how does it serve them? Well, at first it does. There's no more immediate and powerful way to change the way you feel, to relieve your psychic stress, to relieve your physical stress, or just simply to transport you from the everyday grind. That's what they do. And they do it very effectively until, of course, they turn on you because of dependence. And the reason to keep that in mind, I think, is because you can't talk with, you can't approach or help somebody with that problem unless you appreciate that they're doing it or started doing it because it served them. That's how did it serve you? What did it help you with? Then what happened? You have to meet somebody where their heart, their body starts, and that's what the premise of that book is. And there are many solutions for addiction. There's no one route that works singularly or alone. There are many ways that people achieve recovery. And recovery is very, very possible because we have longitudinal studies over long periods of time. People with addictions do recover. And we tend not to hear about them because they're no longer stealing or they're no longer ineffective at work and they don't want to broadcast the fact that they've had this trouble. So we don't see as many people as, in fact, there are who recover.
Excellent. You know, we really are privileged, Adrian, to have this world-class expert with us. So for our listeners, if they want to learn more about your work, and where can they find you? Where are the best places to buy your book and to learn more about your work?
The best place is to go to my website, www.askdrlloyd.com, askdrlloyd.com, one, no spaces, just ask Dr. Lloyd. And pretty much everything that I do, and I write frequently or talk frequently, thanks to people like you, goes up there. And so you can select from what you want. It's free. You can subscribe. And my different books are there in part or introductions to them. That's where that's my Lloyd library, if you will.
Excellent. And it's Lloyd Sederer, just like Federer, he told us earlier, my favorite tennis player of all time. So I knew immediately you and I would be friends. Listen, I want to talk about the workplace again. We found so many people are disillusioned at their workplaces right now. Younger workers especially or feeling that their workplace doesn't care about their mental well-being, and their productivity usually suffers because of that, right? Employee assistant programs and HR counseling had their day back in the 80s, but people are hesitant to use them, and companies seem hesitant to try new solutions. How can corporate leaders start to update their mental health infrastructure to help lighten the load of mental health-related problems in the workplace?
I think it's very hard for many people to get treatment, even if they need it, because of the time, the cost, and the visibility. Oh, I have to leave today at 3:30 because I have to see my psychiatrist, my psychologist. So I think it has to be much more clear and under the surface that we recognize that probably 30% of the people sitting in any room have problems with depression, anxiety, substances, and that we want to acknowledge that that's a problem, and that it's a problem even for me, for example, as a leader, because you don't work as well as you want to work or as well as I want you to work if you're impaired, if you're hungover, or if you're spending time getting a hold of Oxycontin or something. So it's in the business's interest, and it's in the leader's interest to say, look, we know this is very present, and I don't want anybody to just stand up and say so, but we do want to support whatever efforts you undertake. And one of the most important findings I thought over the years was the Surgeon General's report, which said that in getting treatment, any step, any first step is the right step. And that can mean going to a clergy person, that can be going to a trusted friend, primary care doctor, joining a peer support group, whether it's a 12-step group or other groups. These are the first steps, and when someone takes a first step, they're apt to take another step, and because they're among people who are struggling with the same thing, and they're not those people necessarily at their job.
Well, this has been so terrific, Lloyd. I'm really kind of curious. You wrote a book just recently called Ink Stained for Life, about your childhood growing up in the Bronx. Tell us a little bit about your journey. How in the world did you, of all the things you could have pursued in your career back a few decades ago now, decided to go down the road of mental health, which not a lot of people were chasing that back when you began your career? Tell us a little bit about your journey in this book.
Well, this book is 14 stories set from the time I was 8 years old to 17 when I finished high school. And I matched each story with an essay about the theme of the story, the message of the story, its relevance to today. So there are stories from my own life about family business, about gambling, about running away from home, about rich people, about Jewish people. And I pair each with an essay. And the way that happened, which was the first book of that sort that I've written, was I've been writing for a general audience for 10 or 12 years. And 10 years ago, I had never had any training. I decided to sign up for a workshop, which was held at the New School near where I lived in New York. And it was a very popular workshop by a legendary journalist and writer named Bill Zinsser. And Zinsser had this workshop. And in the workshop, about 25 New Yorkers of every stripe would come once a week for a while. And we would be expected to bring something we wrote, anything, 800 words or so. And so I wrote something. And it was the story of my being shaken awake at 8 years old by my father to go work in the family store every Saturday and Sunday. And I felt, of course, like, you know, that this was Dickensian, that I was being denied like a normal kid's life, et cetera, et cetera. And I read the story, and the class seemed, you know, it seemed to resonate with so many people. Of course, it was about family. It was about how work ethic is etched into us. And then Zinsser, wonderful man, big heart, but not very generous in his comments, certainly not gratuitous. After I read it, he said, "It's perfect." And nobody had ever heard him say that. I was stunned. So, because of that, the next day I sent it to the New York Times as an op-ed. And the day after that, they wrote me back and said, "We're going to publish it."
Oh, wow.
There's nothing for a writer to see your work turn around in 24 hours. I mean, it's like a better jolt of dopamine than cocaine, I think. So there it was. And then that was it. I didn't write another one. But 8 years later, I was driving back and forth to Albany a lot, where my official office was for New York State. And Zinsser had died, and he had recorded a few CDs about writing well and memoir. And I was listening to him, and I just had this experience that I had to leave the car, go upstairs to our apartment, and write another story. And I wrote another story that night, and I wrote 13 stories in 13 nights. And I have no idea where it came from. These all were true. I checked with my sister, my relatives, but they were so cordoned off. But once I opened the door, they just poured out. And then I had 14 stories, the original one, and 13 more. But that was not enough to make a book, because as you guys know, books have to reach a certain word count. And I had about 20, and I had a two-book deal with Scribner from the addiction book, but they said, you know, 20,000 words, come back after you win a Pulitzer, because you can't sell it for $26 or $27. So I was not happy about that. I fumed for a couple of days. I dusted myself off, and then I thought, oh, I know how to make this book better and longer. And that's where the essay idea came from. And that didn't take 13 days to write 14 essays. That took a year. And then the book, and I have that book.
Adrian, is that like the best book story we have ever heard, or what?
I mean, we love book stories, and that's awesome, Lloyd. Yeah. That's great.
So great.
Thank you.
Well, let's wrap up. I want to just kind of ask you one big sort of question as we close. We've discussed so much here, and you've worked inside of corporate world. You've worked in the public sector, helping those of us in the corporate world. So if you had to summarize for us, because I loved everything you've said about, you know, sometimes there are times where we just need to take a little time off. We need to be more vulnerable ourselves as leaders. Give us some practical tips as we close here. If we were riding down on the elevator in one of those tall New York buildings and you got a minute with me and Chester, what advice would you give us to help in our organizations this idea of mental health?
I think the most important advice for everybody listening, myself included, is keep hope alive. That these are very troubling conditions, and there are many ways that we each can learn to manage them, even master them. But you have to keep hope alive, because you run into a lot of bumps in the road and you bump your nose a lot. You have to keep hope alive. And then you have to permit yourself, I think, to do certain things that help you with your life. They're basic things. They're well-being. They're about eating right. They're about not drinking too much, not sleeping too much. And then there are a whole set of wonderful and free mind-body interventions, and I've used those myself for decades. And the one that I'm currently practice, I was taught a few years ago, is called yogic breathing, which is very slow breathing, like 5 breaths a minute, inhalation, and then exhalation against a tiny resistance. That is, you ever wonder how Houdini could stay underwater in a safe, chained for so long? I have no idea how he got out of the chains. But for thousands of years, yogis have practiced this type of breathing, and you can lower your heart rate dramatically. 35, 33 beats a minute if you, you know, really practice it. You already, and some people can do it with one respiration a minute. And the effect actually, there's a direct link between the lungs and the brain, because the brain is deeply concerned about getting enough oxygen to the brain. So if you do these respiratory interventions, diaphragmatic interventions, you will quiet your brain, not only your pulse and your heart rate, and respirations. And you too will be able to stay underwater for 5 minutes, but more so, you will quiet yourself at all those moments where you're starting to feel shaken, a little distressed, disturbed by whatever's going on. And the neat thing I like about this is that you can do it anywhere, and you don't have to do it 20 minutes twice a day, like they say, but you could do it while you're stopped at a light during a boring meeting. You can do it with your eyes open. So it is very practical. And throughout the day, I do that. And it's helpfully quiets me down, and it's a consistent go-to for me. So mind, body, and some people like meditation, mindfulness, whatever works for you. But these are ways of taking care of yourself, managing your distress, reducing your anxiety, and enabling you to have a better, fuller life.
You know, I love that tip, Adrian, where you get to the point where you can be meditating with your eyes wide open. How many of our listeners would love to be asleep in a boring meeting and fool everybody in the room, right? Hey, listen, Lloyd, Dr. Sederer, this has been beyond delightful. Thank you so much for your time. You know, I feel like I'm talking to Henry David Thoreau here. Dr. Sederer is up in Concord, New Hampshire. I feel like I'm on Walden Pond, you know, from the guru of anxiety and stress. So can't thank you enough for your time today, for your wisdom, for your humor, and your stories. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you guys, and thank you for all you do.
Adrian, what a delight. What an absolute delight. So I'm always curious. We always take notes during these podcasts. What were your biggest takeaways?
Well, first off, and I think you mentioned it, we really are sitting at the feet of one of the founders of modern thinking about anxiety and mental health. So, really the leader of McLean Hospital for many years, Harvard's teaching hospital for psychiatric work, now adjunct professor at Columbia. I mean, wow. So first off, you know, some great wisdom and some great experience. And I think just his point as he began about, look, we are social creatures. We have to acknowledge that we have become more isolated, and it's okay if we're feeling stressed and anxious. It's a natural response to what's gone on over the last year.
Yeah, to not be embarrassed about it. You're not alone is kind of what I took out of that. And I couldn't agree with you more with his gravitas and his experience. And I just thought it was hilarious. He's in Concord, New Hampshire. I mean, we talk about great thinkers, you know. I mean, you can't make it up, right? I'll tell you, the other thing that I really hit home to me is when he said their tagline is, even heroes need to talk. That, you know, it's okay. Now, the thing about that I thought was so fascinating, we've never heard this before, is the dynamic of the peer-to-peer relationship. That, you know, firefighters wanted to talk to firefighters, nurses wanted to talk to nurses. This idea of talking to your boss, that there was a power disparity that he talked about, that it's never going to be safe there. There's always a different kind of relationship. When you can talk to somebody that's been through what you've been through, then you can open up. He even talked about war veterans. Didn't you find that to be fascinating?
I did. I took actually quite a bit of notes there because you're right. We haven't talked as much about that on our podcast, but you know, the idea is we have this game face, he called it, and I understand that completely. We're very protective of our reputation, and but boy, we can be quite vulnerable when it's with a peer, somebody who gets what we are going through or have gone through. So again, a great little tip for leaders or team members to be able to create safety, maybe not top down as much, but side to side. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes as a leader, we say, gee, we've got to find the solution. Well, finding the solution might be not to talk to you, to find someone they can talk to. And the other thing he said that was so powerful is particularly around addiction, where he said, any first step is the right step. I thought that was just so succinct. When he said that, what came to your mind?
And again, it comes back to support, because a lot of people listening to this maybe are feeling some addiction themselves. And I love it when you put in other things like food. Some people get addicted to exercise. You think of positive things like food and exercise, but you can become literally addicted to a lot of things. And I loved what he was saying about, think about that this addiction in the beginning served them.
Right.
You know, maybe they were feeling overweight, so they started exercising. Maybe they were feeling insecure, so they started eating. Or it might be alcohol, drugs, something even more sort of severe. But it was doing them some good for a while till, I love that he said, it turned on them. But he said, meet them where they started. How did this help you? And what can I do, perhaps, in a small way to help where the substance helped?
Right. And that first step, you know, whether it's AA or it's talking to a friend or whatever it might be, I just love that whatever your first step is, it's the right first step. Well, and then, you know, as we wrapped up the ink-stained life, you know, his stories, he's just got such a wonderful voice. And I'm actually sorry this is a podcast, because if you were to see Dr. Lloyd, I mean, he's just right out of Central Casting. Just puts you at ease. He's got that easy way about him. He's just, you just think, oh my gosh, I could talk to this guy about anything. But the idea that he wrote these 17 essays about his life, it's so funny. I know you're not supposed to do this when you're, you know, podcasting. I went on Amazon and I actually looked that up, and I'm going to buy that book.
I did too. We were both podcasting, and I could see Chester and I both Googling it, going, this sounds terrific. Yeah.
I'm buying it.
Hey,
last thought here.
Yeah. Go ahead. That's awesome. Last thought here. And, you know, this is for all leaders, all employees, because we're talking anxiety at work. I just loved it when he said, look, here's one of the world's experts on mental health saying, assume 30% of people in any room you're in are having problems right now with anxiety, depression, substances. It's a real problem. Ignore this at your peril. So I just thought that was really good. And then he gave us three wonderful ideas at the end. Keep hope alive. Permit yourself to do helpful things like eating right and don't abusing things, and focus on your mind body, like things like, you know, yogic breathing and other ideas. So I love that idea. It's a real issue. Probably a third of people are facing this, but here are some positive steps, right?
Yeah. And at the end we said, look, and I do this, you know, here's the world's expert, and he has those anxious moments. Well, listen, another great podcast. I really hope that you'll join us in our community. We thrive together.global, where we have a safe place to talk about wellness and anxiety at work. If you like this podcast, download it, give us 5 stars, send it to your friends. If you don't like it, just keep it to yourself, right, Adrian?
Exactly.
And then, of course, I'm going to pass it to my good friend and co-author, Adrian Gostick, to tell you why you should buy a copy of Anxiety at Work and support this work and get the word out. So, Adrian, wrap it up.
Well, we'd love you to support Anxiety at Work. We have had such amazing feedback on the book itself because it's the first tool out there that can really help business people deal with this important subject that Dr. Sederer has been talking about for the last 45 minutes here. So we want to encourage you to pick up a copy and let us know what you think. We think there are terrific ideas in there to help you build the resilience, not only of yourself, but those around you. So we want to thank our producer, Brent Klein, our terrific guest host, Christy Lawrence, who finds all these amazing guests, and to all of you for listening in. If you'd like to learn more, check out our online community, wethrivetogether.global, and where we're trying to create a safe place to talk about anxiety and mental health at work. Right, Chess?
You bet. Follow us on LinkedIn. And again, thanks for your time. Take care. And we hope you have an anxious, free week.